Committee meeting is now in session. This is our afternoon session on the 19th of October, 2006. One committee matter before we get into everything else. We have some dates that are firm now. Our next public meeting will be June 19th and 20th. And that's a Tuesday and Wednesday. Is there any problems with anybody on that?
The next one is...
I'm sorry. After the January meeting. The January meeting is still as scheduled. January 31st and February 1st. But we did some talking about the other two dates next year. So now we're going in June on the 19th and 20th. I'm sorry? 19th? Yeah. 19th and 20th. And the October dates are the 24th and 25th. If everybody has that, we're in good shape.
June 19th is a particularly auspicious. It's my 53rd wedding anniversary.
You always have something to celebrate when I come to one of these.
I celebrate every day.
Okay. I'm with you.
Give me the other one. October?
October 24th, 25th.
Okay.
Members of the public are welcome to these public meetings. Any member of the public wishing to address the committee on matters not appearing on the agenda may do so now. The public may comment on any matter listed on the agenda at the time the matter is being considered by the committee. There will be a time limit of not more than 5 minutes for each speaker. No action will be taken by the committee on matters brought up under this item, but they may be referred to staff for further study, response, or action. With that, I would like to turn the meeting over to Steve Chestnut, who will introduce presentations.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before I do that, I would like to follow up on a question that came up yesterday during Donna Jacobs' presentation under item tab 8, which was how frequent are the turbine valve tests performed, and that is on a 6-month frequency.
Does that require a back-off and power to do them?
Yes, it does. And that came up during the power history discussion that she had. So with that, I'd like to introduce the next presentation. This will be done by Mr. Dave Taggart.
And as well as to, I know another topic you wanted to talk about was the mid-cycle assessment versus our QPAR messages. So you know, where the continuity is there. Okay, overall performance for Diablo Canyon, we felt that the plant continued to operate in a safe and conservative fashion, and also noted that the operational performance indicators at the plant continued to improve at the facility. Reflecting back on the second quarter, that also encompassed our last refueling outage for Unit 2. And overall, plant outage performance we felt was satisfactory and demonstrated a step improvement from previous outages in performance, quality performance. I would note, though, there are a number of gaps to excellence that continue to exist in the area of planning, scope control, and in some areas with execution of various projects. Some of the challenges that did occur during this last outage were in the area of maintenance work practices and industrial safety, and both of those are the issues related to those are both what we consider to be behavior and standards based issues. And I'm going to go into some of these later as I go into the individual department performance summaries. Maintenance craft quality of work, the actual work itself really has significantly improved the plant reliability out there. So the actual performance of equipment, plant equipment, has been very good. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the process issues that we do have with the maintenance organization, but the actual work, physical work out there has been very good and has improved plant reliability and equipment reliability. Next slide. Thank you. Also during this period, the Quality Verification Organization conducted the biennial audit of the performance improvement programs. And specifically, audits of performance improvement programs encompass the previous corrective action program audit that I know you guys are very familiar with. But we also looked at elements of human performance, self-assessment, operating experience. We looked at the functions of the review bodies, including Corrective Action Review Board and PSRC activities, as well as apparent causes and cause analysis. We had a number of industry peers on this audit of various performance improvement in the area of corrective action. We thought that there was also improved performance in the area of formal cause analysis, and that had been a previous issue on earlier audits. And we're talking about formal cause analysis. However, we did find the area of apparent cause evaluations to warrant some improvement, some increased rigor, as well as the grading of the apparent cause evaluation, which would integrate the improvement into that process. So we have a grading process that the corrective action group performs.
Dave, could you explain the difference between the apparent and the formal cause?
Okay, the difference between the apparent cause and the formal cause analysis. The formal cause analysis are done on our most significant issue, what we call in quality assurance, where the significant conditions adverse to quality. Those are your high-tier quality problems. It's more of a rigorous, detailed analysis of the cause of the problem, and it uses approved methods like cause and effects analysis, and there's other methodology, MORT. There's various tools out there. The apparent cause is for the lesser quality problems. Still, quality problems, but not significant conditions adverse to quality, but more than problems that you want just to fix. You want to go back and look at what is your estimation of what the cause is. You are doing the detailed analysis like you do in a formal cause analysis, but you are getting, essentially, that's why it's called apparent, getting to the cause of the problem. So it's a little less rigorous, but it still has a process control related to that. But both of them are trying to get at the cause. Again, apparent cause for the lesser significant problems, formal cause for the more significant problems.
Dave, I had a follow-up question on that area. When you make a statement or inform the organization that improvements are needed in the area of apparent cause evaluations, what happens subsequent to you making this known to them?
Okay, well, we identified the need for improvements in the apparent cause analysis, the area of grading. We actually had input from our industry peers as to typical methodologies and models that we could apply to grade our apparent causes. And we had some essential elements that we considered to be, if they didn't meet it, it would be a flaw for that cause analysis, and we rejected. So what we've done is, one, from going forward, we provided that model, and they have instilled that model into their process going forward. In addition, on the specific issues that we identified, we gave them a list of specific apparent causes where we felt there were issues, and they went back to address those specific problems. So they got a follow-up by the quality organization to look at confirmation, did they do exactly what they had proposed to do. We also look at, if we're not tagging an individual problem, we'll also look at periodic assessments of the program. For instance, we are planning on doing a follow-up assessment, not an audit, but an assessment of some of the selective elements of this corrective action audit from earlier this year. And that's coming up before the end of the year, so we'll be looking at that. We also will look at, on the next audit, we would also routinely look at past problems to look at effectiveness of those problems. So, for instance, in 2008, we will be doing another very intensive look at the performance improvement area by audit. And as part of that, we'll be looking at the past audit findings as well as other trends and issues that have occurred during that period, and selectively look at those for effectiveness of corrective actions as well as completion of those corrective actions.
So is it safe to say that this type of formality in terms of follow-up occurs with all the issues that you identify to the organization?
Yes, this is a typical approach that's fairly not only is it standard in the industry, but it is one of our approaches that is specified in our quality assurance program, that we go out, and depending on the significance of the problem, that we go out to immediately do a verification, or we'll go out and look at it during the next evaluation or assessment.
Just one more follow-up. In the event that your follow-up indicates that insufficient action has occurred to correct the issue, what happens then?
Okay, if we go in our follow-up and we find out that a corrective action that was specified did not occur or was ineffective, we would not only identify back the original issue, but then we would also identify that the process somehow did not get the results that we wanted. So the corrective action process in that case would also be identified as a problem. So you'd have two problems in that situation.
And then at some point in time, do you reach a conclusion that your concerns have to be elevated further in the management chain of the organization?
There may be a situation where our concerns could be elevated up if we feel that's been ineffective corrective action, and we would elevate those up through various means of communication. We would also, and depending on the significance, the elevation could be a higher level of quality problem. Let's say we have a nonconformance process that documents our significant conditions adverse to quality.
On the effectiveness, I mean, not just looking at the processes involved, but looking at the hard results of the corrective action program, in other words, preventing of repeat problems, that sort of thing. Do you look at that tangible evidence?
Well, I think that actually that's a very good point. I think repeat problems is a specific indicator of how effective your corrective action program is, as well as going back and looking at when quality goes back and looks at effectiveness of corrective actions based on not only our findings, but we'll also look at effectiveness of corrective actions that were identified through the plant system, something that were self-revealing and been addressed by the plant, looking at those effectiveness of corrective actions. I mean, that definitely would be an indicator on how well the program is working. We also look at, and we monitor this on a monthly basis as well as quarterly basis in our QPAR, overall performance in the corrective action area. We look at the problem prevention resolution report, the indicators that come out. We have actually go back, we'll challenge those indicators and validate some of those indicators to see if they're actually accurate or not from an independent perspective.
Does someone either in your organization or the corrective action program organization look periodically, okay, we have an event. Now, has that happened before? And do they trace those back to see, had they tried to correct them and they keep popping up? Or
yeah, yes, in fact they do. Depending on the significance of the problem, if let's say a problem occurred and it's a significant condition adverse to quality or a condition adverse to quality that you're applying an apparent cause, one of the elements you look at during a formal cause analysis in apparent cause is, has this problem previously occurred? What were those corrective actions? Were those effective? What were the barriers that should have been there to prevent this problem from reoccurring or from
Okay, so it's done routinely.
Routinely. And the corrective action group also looks at on a monitoring basis, on a monthly basis. They'll look at individual corrective action completion, and they'll do a independent perspective from their standpoint, since they're the program owners,
mm-hmm. Okay.
Independent of what we do.
Thank you.
Let me come in there with another question. Is the QPAR the main means of communicating the findings of effectiveness or not effectiveness, not effective of various actions?
The quality performance assessment report, I would say, is a vehicle that rolls up the overall performance, and it does integrate not only does the quality assurance audits, inspections, independent reviews, but also other elements that occurred during the regulatory-driven audits, as well as we supplement those audits with what we call assessments, or we newly formed what we call a short-form assessment, which is more of an observation type. All those vehicles will look at an activity or an element of a program and will report. And a quality assurance audit, one of the objectives is to look at the adequacy of the quality assurance program as well as the effectiveness of that activity as well as compliance to that activity. And what we've also instilled as part of that process, also excellence criteria related to, say, IMPO good practices and so forth. So compliance, but we do it in a performance-based manner. A performance-based manner, meaning that we'll look at, from an engineering standpoint, we'll look at engineering analyses, or we'll do field observations. You look at results, you look at the performance, not just look at the paper.
I think we should let you continue.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
While we're talking about the QPAR, I think the QPAR for a long time has been done a very good job in identifying problems, long-standing problems. There's been a lot of problems continue to be identified. What does the line organization do with that QPOR? How far down does it go in disseminating the information in there to be read, and what kind of response you get from that?
I think it varies by organization. I know the operations organization, I feel, does a good job by having the QPAR briefed with their crews. I think Steve Davis done a really good job on that. But I think it's inconsistent on that. The QPAR, you know, does identify problems, and as well as audits. I think the key to problem identification is just one element of it, is the obviously the correction and the follow-through. And that's where you do rely heavily on your corrective action program. That's why this performance improvement audit is a very important audit for our organization to look at, because the effectiveness of the quality program is impacted by the effectiveness of your corrective action program. That does have a direct impact on that. Okay, thank you. I would say in the areas identified in the performance improvement audit, there were a number of issues that we did identify, and a number of actions have been taken as a result of that audit. Again, we're going to be doing another follow-up assessment of that later this year. I would say that looking back at that, the audit, as well as looking at the NRC inspection report, I think that there was a lot of consistency between the two. The NRC did a problem prevention resolution inspection. Recent roll-up process, performance improvement roll-up process that the departments have been implementing, where they're looking at not only feedback from the quality organization and other third-party organizations, but all their quality problems and their own management observations, and doing a roll-up of that. And that's based on the industry best practice. That is a very positive improvement that the plan has implemented, and started implementing that in July. That's going to go a long ways, I think, for sustainability in this area. Again, we'll be monitoring that process also. The recent mid-cycle assessment, we felt we were not on this particular self-assessment this time. Now, 2 years ago, I actually was on the self-assessment. We remain independent of that. But the mid-cycle assessment, in our opinion, was a very good assessment. That was excellent. We felt that it had some good insights related to the area of identifying problems, but engaging the workforce in the solution of those problems, in the analysis and solution of those problems. And the mid-cycle assessment really highlighted that. And I would say that was something, we did not highlight that from an independent standpoint. The mid-cycle did that. And it makes a lot of sense. I think it's a good, that is. That is a good direction. So that was a great insight on that.
David,
yes?
Just so I understand, let's take that example. Let's take that good insight, the need for engaging employees everywhere, of course, but to identify corrective actions in areas that are industry gaps. With that insight, where do you go? What do you do? Where does that insight go? Who works on it? What's put in place? What kind of execution is there? Who follows it up? And anything else you can think of.
Well,
so I can understand what happens to these insights.
Okay. Well, I think a great model of that is recent area in industrial safety, where we engaged the cross-section of our organization to improve industrial safety, personnel safety at the plant. And they went out, and again, it's the grassroots of the organization, to go in to identify, looking at the problem, and looking at potential areas of solution, as well as participating in benchmarking at other facilities. So it's not just the manager going out benchmarking. It's the individual workers. They're the ones out there. They're the ones dealing it day to day. And when you do that, I think you get a better product, but you also instill ownership of that issue. And that is a very important element of any performance improvement, getting ownership throughout the organizations. So engaging the workforce clearly gets them involved in the problem, gets them involved in the solution that they have. The cause analysis process is an opportunity to engage the workforce in analyzing and being party to what are the potential solutions to those causes. Because we identify what the problem is, we identify potential solutions. They need to be involved in that discussion. So we're dealing with effective action. So that's an opportunity to engage that workforce.
And in the past, we didn't do that.
No, not to the extent.
Okay.
Right. And this is what the mid-cycle pointed out. We had some areas.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. I would say it was an excellent assessment. I would say also that the results of the mid-cycle assessment was consistent with the QPAR results that have been saying. Also recognize that the mid-cycle assessment also looks at the QPAR as input in addition. So there is some continuity there. But I would say very, very good assessment, consistent messages, some great insights that we didn't offer, and we'll be monitoring the progress of that assessment from an independence perspective.
Okay.
Thanks. I want to briefly go over some of the department performance summaries by organization. Operations, and there's just some highlights here. Looking at this second period quality performance assessment report, we felt that there was definitely a step change in performance with the operations organization. We felt that, again, reflected back on the refueling outage, during fuel load and reload, we felt that the communication practices were very good, and we had people out there observing, our operational QA people observing that activity. We felt that some of the gaps to excellence were in the plant status control and human performance, and both of those areas are being addressed in the corrective action program. We're being addressed in the corrective action program.
Step change in improvement. Can you give us your basis for that?
Yeah, looking at the performance number of issues that were identified during the last refueling outage in the area of operations, we did have a number of problems from the previous outage that we felt that operations improved on during this refueling outage. So just reflecting back on past outages, independently looking at some of their trends, performance, quality performance of execution of work, we didn't have some of the higher level issues that we had previously, and we felt that was a step change in positive performance improvement.
Are there actual measures that you point back to say about the step change?
Well, we looked at actual issues that were quality problems that were identified during the past refueling outage, and as part of our follow-up, yes.
Okay.
And this is really from a standpoint, going back to the comment about effectiveness. And sometimes the opportunity for effectiveness isn't until the next refueling outage, so you're able to look at how well are we doing.
Also, one of the gaps to excellence, the plant status control.
Right.
We've been attuned to that here lately. Can you say?
Yeah, complete.
Okay. All right.
Maintenance organization, again, reflecting on my first slide, I felt that the quality of maintenance workship itself has improved plant equipment and plant reliability of plant. I think if you look at the indicators, you'll reflect that, but just looking at the work activity work. However, some of the gaps to excellence that we identify were in the administrative work processes and behaviors. And specifically, we're talking about work package quality, following that work package in the field, related to walk downs prior to doing the work, also related to procedure use and adherence and placekeeping issues. I would say those are kind of those are required issues. Those are the bread and butter of following the program. So work itself is getting done well, and good equipment reliability, but the processes related to that need to improve. And sometimes our processors are a little inefficient, and that's been an area that we've also identified as an area warranting improvement in certain cases, improving the efficiency. But I would say the key there is our work planning, work package quality has been a key to that.
That's all part of your work control process, is that right?
Work control and the work planning. The planning, we have a set of planners that will schedule work, and as part of that process, you'll do field walk downs and so forth.
If I recall, I think you revised or revamped the work control process a year or two ago.
Yes.
There were some wrinkles in getting that implemented. What does that look like now?
Well, the work control, in fact, I'm going to talk a little bit about work control here in a couple of minutes, but the work control really is more of a prioritization and execution of work. Where here I'm talking about how the work in the field is being executed per work order basis. So, again, this is an area that warrants some continued monitoring.
Dave, do the line organization directors and managers agree with QB's assessment of these gaps?
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. In fact, we had asked if you reflect back, in fact, this particular QPAR, we specifically asked for a response from the maintenance organization, and we got a response acknowledging those issues and identifying to us what they're doing to address those issues.
Identifying a schedule to do that?
Yes. Also reflecting back on the last outage, two issues that also came out were the foreign material exclusion area, and this was in the reactor cavity. I think you're familiar with some of those issues, and rigging implementation.
Dave, before you leave maintenance, we had a rather lively discussion yesterday in your absence on the procedure use. I'm referring now to a cover letter that submitted the refueling activities audit for 2R13 and signed off by Mr. Prigmore. And at the very bottom, it talks about attaining top-level performance and the inability to achieve it as long as there are issues with mispositionings and procedure use. Now, this is dated the 29th of June, and I know this is only October, but I guess I'd seek your view on whether there's been any improvement with respect to either one of those issues.
Well, these issues, I would say that these issues are currently in the corrective action system, and they're working on it. We're not done with those issues yet. I'd say it's still an open issue from our standpoint. So I'll leave it with that. It's still an open issue.
Okay, and I guess my peak of curiosity is recognizing that this was dated the 29th of June and flagging those kinds of issues. I have to note that both in July and August, the mispositioning events increased. So I'm not so sure, at least I'm uncertain as to what corrective action is doing with respect to dampening those issues.
Yeah, I would reflect back to the actual corrective action document addressing that issue. It is something we're actually, raising in this coming QPAR, kind of the same message. It doesn't seem to be going on point to where we felt it was going, and it does warrant some additional attention.
Yeah. Have either one or both of those issues been raised to a higher order of management in the organization?
That issue actually has been raised as not even by quality, but through the management review process. Now it's on a 2-month basis, but the management team consists of all the directors, officers, and the managers. That is one of the items that gets reviewed on that, and that's actually been raised through that process. There's actually an indicator that monitors that, so that's gotten a lot of attention by the plant staff.
So without putting words in your mouth, I guess what I'm hearing you say is there's some diligent attention being paid to both of these
system engineers. In-service inspection did a very good job during the refueling outage. Reactor engineering done very well. Those are real positive points. We also felt that the use of the engineering human performance simulator, and I don't know if you had the opportunity to observe that, but had some unique aspects to that that I think not only applies to engineering but applies to any of the organizations, and I thought that was pretty innovative on that. So that was really good performance by the engineering organization on that. Gaps to excellence in engineering, I would say it was in the area of engineering technical oversight, and specifically what I'm talking about here is in the area related to the recirc sump analysis being done by one of our sub suppliers, and we had a number of issues identified by the quality assurance organization, technical errors as part of that process, and that's why this is on the board as a gaps to excellence. We felt the engineering organization should have identified that, and we found a number of issues related to that. Security organization, we did a fitness for duty assessment during this period. It did good performance in that area. They had a successful force-on-force drill. And in past issues, there were in a corrective action program related to safeguards information. Seemed to be very, very effective. I feel security continues to be doing a good job out there. Okay, outage management. And here we're talking about the outage organization itself. And we felt that reflecting back on the performance of the outage, and when here we're looking at the leadership associated with that, we felt there was effective leadership by the outage director specifically, did an excellent job. And he actually instituted Mr. Ken Langdon, instituted a number of process improvements that were very good. Not only were they structural office arrangements in the OCC to instill improved communications on members, but also looking at the roles and responsibilities. He also instilled what we called outage fundamentals. And outage fundamentals, basically good principles for outage execution that he brought with him. Those outage fundamentals are actually being used as right now as a good model for the rest of the plant organization to go back and look at what are their fundamentals. So I think the outage management team were a leader in that area, good performance. Now, some of the gaps to excellence in the outage you don't need to be doing, that's going to affect performance, not only affect human performance, but the quality performance. So scope control, we have deadlines, we have an execution of a process, trying to follow that, and we struggle with that at times. Work control activities have categories of schedule adherence, called category A schedule, more significant items. During this period, during this whole period, the second quarter, they were at 100%. And we've declined a little bit during this current period, but that was generally good performance. And the AR backlog on corrective maintenance is really up there with industry best. And that's something that's monitored, and we know we look at what industry best on there for the addressing our backlog on that. So those are real good performance issues. Gaps to excellence, we say elective maintenance, things that aren't corrective maintenance, but elective maintenance. And on our backlog on that, around 530 per unit during this period. It's improved more recently down to 450 per unit, but the industry goals are 275. So we need to place some attention on that area. They are working it down, but still warrants some attention. Again, it's a trade-off on corrective maintenance and elective maintenance.
Are a lot of these little issues that are really too small to pay attention to right away, but the numbers are there?
Right. But it's still an indicator what's important on these indicators, you do want to address these corrective maintenance issues. That's why that's important, that be a good number on there. Elective maintenance, we still want to address those because that's going forward for sustainability. You don't want to get into corrective maintenance, but you still want to have attention on that. So that's why it's monitored on really more of an industry basis.
Well, you've always got the judgment to make about the vital few and the trivial many. But a nuclear plant operates in licensing space, which means you're going to be accountable for the numbers. And the numbers may not show which of these are more important than others. You've got to make judgments about that. It's good to get this backlog down. Is the problem that there just isn't time to do it, or what?
It's really a resource application. Definitely have adequate resource, but what are you working on at the moment? And if you have a lot of activity going on, a plant emergent issue would come up. That would take some of that resource that you'd be applying on electives. And this continues to be a challenge when you have attrition, retirements, and that's the real world here. And making sure these are the backup teams. You always have adequate resource for emergency preparedness, but you have several backups, and we've had some cases where some of the backup positions needed to be filled. So that's an area that continues to be monitored. It's high on their list of dealing with an EP organization, as well as we have dedicated individuals that look at the various facilities. The other one is emergency preparedness equipment adverse trends, and here I'm talking about the VAN system, the voice actuation system, calls out, our ear system, some of the communication tools that we use, and there's an adverse trend that's being monitored on that. The EP organization is on top of this issue. There's a number of ARs been addressed and are being followed up on.
Dave, are there actual vacancies in the ERO team?
Recognizing the ERO, there's an ERO team. There will always be a resource for an ERO team. But then we have backup, where you have reliefs where you have three, actually you can have up to four backups. And we have, in some of those positions, you have vacancies. So what happens is some individuals end up doing double duty at times. So it's more of a, you know, individual impact. But
so the first team's in place.
There's adequate resource for, always adequate resource. But we're talking about the backup team. Again, looking at, you know, long-term and looking at the individuals that are on that team.
All right, another question before you leave this page. You've been using the terms good performance
yes.
and gaps to excellence. I understand good performance, I think. Gaps to excellence seems to me to be what you need to do to improve a good system to make it excellent. Now, what if you found deficiencies or inadequacies or something unsatisfactory? What would you call that? Would that be a gap to excellence, too?
Well, I would say a deficiency definitely would be a gap to excellence.
But not all gaps to excellence need to be deficiencies.
That's correct. That's correct. It may be a performance. That's right.
So how would you characterize a failing of a organization or a process? What would you call that? A finding or a deficiency?
Well, if it's a... from our standpoint, it would be a finding, which would result in a quality problem. And that's really more of a regulatory-driven definition. Again, we're looking at not only a regulatory, Diablo is going beyond meeting regulatory, we're going for the excellence. That's a deficiency, that's a violation of the QA program. Having backups, resources for your backup teams, something you want to have, but again, that's excellence.
I'm just working with the terminology. How would I look at this list of all these gaps to excellence and know which ones are efficiencies and which ones are truly gaps to excellence?
Yeah, I'd say...
if I were a line organization, how would I know?
Okay, well, that's very, very clear for a line organization because the corrective action program clearly identifies where it's a regulatory issue or not. And,
so
we'll
spell that in the corrective action
program. If it's a gap, let's say it's to an industry standard, we would cite, a good practice. That would be a gap to excellence. May meet the regulatory requirements,
right.
But maybe somebody else is doing that particular activity better than we are, and we want to be the leading utility. So that's what we're going to be.
Yeah, those are treated one way, but if you have a deficiency where you're not up to minimum standards,
right. That's
got to be treated a little differently.
That's right.
That's right. It's clear to the line organizations.
Yes.
Which are deficiencies and which are the gaps.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Very clear. Okay. This last slide is we identify in the QPAR, and we update this. This is kind of looking again, where are some of the key quality performance issues? And this is a list. It's not like a top 10 list, not necessarily 10 or anything like that. These are our top issues where we warrant heightened awareness. And again, these typically are, we discuss these issues within the QPAR and in past audits. This is a list that we monitor the organization on. And it's up to us. I mean, we take it off. They could have an existing problem still open. We feel confident on it. We'll take it off. If they have an item in the corrective action program, they've addressed it, we still have some issues, we're going to leave it on. So this is our independent list of what we're looking at. And as you see, the top one, industrial safety behaviors, that has obviously, has not an NRC perspective, but that's a performance perspective.
So are these more or less in priority order or order of importance?
No, there's no list of priority, though I would say safety should be number one, and it is number one.
Dave, item number three, long-standing
yes.
equipment issues, has been around a long, long, long time. And I know you're making improvements in that area, but when is that issue going to be resolved?
Well, I'd say, reflecting back, there were a number of long-term equipment issues that were addressed. We're going to follow through on that, what they're doing on that. So there were still some issues. But I would say there was a number of high-priority issues. There was two issues going back on long-term standing problems. One is we didn't have an infrastructure built at the facility to prioritize and evaluate these issues. That's been addressed. I mean, we have that process in place. There's a prioritization process. There's a dedicated management review. That's going really well. Well, we're leaving it on there. How are you dealing with the issues themselves? Are you addressing some of those issues? There are still some issues out there that we need another refueling outage to go
what
forth.
What is the plant goal for resolving this? Do they have a goal out there?
There is a, offhand, I can't tell you what that specific target date is. There is a due date. I don't know if Steve.
The station goal, as stated in the DCPP performance plan, is to complete all resolution of all long-standing equipment issues scheduled for 2006. All right. And also looking ahead to 2007, we just heard out 1R14, 2R14 scope. A few long-standing equipment issues are clearly identified on that list of major scope.
What I just heard Dave say, though, it looks like you're not going to make 2006. You still got some issues out there.
The ones that we have scheduled to be complete in 2006, we're, to my knowledge, on track to still complete those. However, there are still some that are required additional planning, scheduling, and resources to complete. Those are in the following refueling outage in the 14s.
So, yeah, specifically the ones that we identified for this refueling outage we addressed, but there are some other issues that do require additional refueling outages.
Is there a list associated with these?
Yes.
Seen that?
Yes.
Okay. Yes,
that subject's coming up in a few minutes, so we might want to address it then. Okay.
Good point. And with that, this concludes my presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
Okay, thank you very much.
Are there any further questions here? Jill? Jim?
I do have a curiosity question. On that very last slide where you talked about the quality performance issues, number 4, where it says performance improvement and mm-hmm. lists everything from apparent cause evaluation to training. Mm-hmm. Is that called performance improvement or the learning organization? I have a little bit of issue with nomenclature because they mean different things.
Well, the terminology performance improvement, if you look at the info criteria, these would fall under performance improvement by info definition. The issues here are really more related to the process and programs. So, that answer your question?
Okay.
Thank you, Sheila. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, very good. Steve?
Okay, next up we have Mr. Ken Peters, the Director of Engineering. He will be presenting the next two topics for the board. First topic will be on the status of the NRC containment sump issue, and the second topic will be status of long-standing equipment issues.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon.
Ken, it's nice to see you back. We met you formally last public meeting, and so we're glad to see you again.
Okay, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here this afternoon.
Okay.
Thank you. So the first item for me on the agenda is to talk about the containment research sump strainer issue. So just a quick agenda there of the slides. We'll talk about the current Diablo design basis, improvements we've made already, the NRC requests and their generic letter, and then kind of where we stand relative to that issue. So our current licensing basis is, as you know, we're required to be designed for a number of potential incident scenarios, low probability, but nonetheless, they form the part of our design basis. One of those would be what we would call a loss of coolant accident, a break of a large pipe inside containment. Now, that would release both water from the reactor coolant system as well as potential energy with the system being at high pressure. That discharge could damage related material in containment, such as the insulation systems that are on various plant piping systems. In the event of that kind of incident, the water that would be discharged would collect in the bottom of containment and make its way to the containment sump. And then the sump collects water and uses that in the emergency core cooling system to be pumped back in and cool the reactor. Okay. Diablo current status, in 2000 and 2001, we proactively replaced our existing sump screens, which at the time was really, we were the leader in the industry. Most pressurized water reactors, of which Diablo is one, initially had sump screens.
Either unit, but how many physically different screens add up to 700 square feet?
Off the top of my head, I don't know that.
Is the number like 3, or is it Like 20 or 30? Or?
It would be more in the neighborhood of 30. It is multiple plates with holes.
I just needed a feel for this in this plan.
Yeah, and in fact, you'll see later there's a brief picture of the proposed new screen, so that might help also. Okay. So the NRC issued a letter called a generic letter to the industry that was in 2004 and raised a generic issue with the industry of the potential for screens to be blocked by what in the generic letter is called debris, which is potentially insulation material or other similar material that could be washed to the sump in the event of an accident. And what it requested was that all pressurized waters in the water reactors in the country look at their screens, evaluate their design, and consider the potential for blockage, and basically requested that everybody upgrade their screens and increase the size of them. Ken. So we've looked at that for Diablo Canyon, and we believe that there are two things we need to do, and this is consistent with what the rest of the industry is doing. We're looking to reduce the amount of fibrous material that could be washed to the sump in the event of an accident. So that material takes the form of insulation on piping, by and large. So the reactor coolant system piping has insulation. Steam generators have insulation. And there are different materials used in different systems. Some of it's calcium silicate insulation. There are other materials. So in some cases, we will physically remove that during our upcoming outages. In some cases, we might jacket that with metal insulation. And then the other thing we need to do is replace our screen size, is where we are at this point. Thanks, Ken. So going forward, we've issued a contract to a firm to design, test, and procure and install new screens. So the current plan for our units is to replace the Unit 1 screens in our upcoming refueling outage. That's 1R14, so in Unit 1, and that'll be the spring. Depending on the plant screen size, the replaced screen size is typically between 3,000 and 5,000 square feet in area, depending on a particular plant's analysis. So we issued that contract. We're currently with our vendor testing the Diablo Canyon specific insulation material mixture that would be available in containment, and that testing will be completed by the end of November of this year. As I mentioned before, that's a just kind of a quick artist rendering of the proposed screen design for the new sumps.
Ken, is the screen design based on this November test? Will the results of those tests dictate what your screen design looks like?
Yes, sir. We have the basic design with our vendor, you know, as far as what the actual area is and hole size, but those tests will either confirm that that's acceptable or we might need to make slight modifications to the screen, but that will test the proposed screen.
Is there any way that you can quantify to us how much insulation you're taking out or wrapping or, I mean?
Yeah, I don't, off the top of my head, I don't have a specific figure of how much we're taking out. But I can tell you the result of that work, what we have left in containment that would be susceptible to being washed to the sump, we expect to be on the order of about 40 pounds. Based on the analytical work we've done to date, we think that would be acceptable with the screen design that we're proposing. And that seems to be typical throughout the industry, although, as I said, each plant is different.
How many?
So 40 pounds would be left. How much was there, pounds compared to that 40? What was there before?
Right. I don't have that figure off the top of my head. We could get that to you, though, if you'd like.
How many units like this would end up in the plant after you do all these changes? All right, is this picture mod one or a typical unit or a unique unit? How many of these things are you going to need?
I'm sorry?
How many of these things are you going to need?
That is the sump screen that we would end up with.
That's the main sump screen.
Yes, sir.
Down at the And that's the main replacement that you would have would be that.
Yes, sir.
And that enclosure, yellow enclosure, is your current sump screen enclosure.
Right.
So you're putting more square feet in that space. It's
yes.
Not more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, we'll fit it in the same footprint. So our ongoing work in progress, but at this point we don't believe they can. We are continuing to look at that, though, as the second bullet mentions. We have a team of folks at the plant that are looking at alternative solutions because there might be a better solution than the large screen replacement. So we continue to work that in parallel. But when we are done, we will have resolved this issue. And then, of course, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, as they do with all plants, they come back and review the plant's design changes for this generic issue. And as plants have started to replace their screens or made other modifications, the NRC has their inspectors come out and examine those modifications to make sure they meet the requirements.
You mentioned Unit 2 is going to be changed in 2R14.
Yes, sir.
Which is after the 2007 cutoff date. Have you got special exemption for that? Or what?
We will have to submit that. That's a good point. We have not done that yet. What you're asking is the generic letter requested that these issues be resolved for all plants by the end of 2007. So for Unit 2, our next refueling outage will be approximately 5 weeks later than that. So we have a draft letter to the NRC requesting that scheduler exemption. We expect to submit that basically by the end of October. And the NRC has already granted similar scheduler exemptions to about 10 units in the country. So we will need that.
Ken, can I follow up on that a bit?
Yes, sir.
You have a letter that was submitted September 1st on this issue where you told the NRC that you needed a schedule extension of approximately 5 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Is that not a request? You're talking about a subsequent request now by the end of October?
Yes, sir. That was basically previewing that for them, and then as plants started requesting scheduler relief, the NRC put out some specific guidance of certain points you need to cover, so we do need a separate letter that lays out exactly the mitigating strategy and the issues, the items we've completed to date, mm-hmm. and why we believe that additional 5 weeks is acceptable. So we will need a separate letter.
How conversant is your NRC project manager with the status of where you are on this issue?
That's a good question. In fact, he's very conversant. Myself and our licensing manager met with he and the division director at the NRC in Washington Tuesday.
Okay.
So we went over with them what our current status
is and what your final design is going to look like.
There is, I'd say that the general design is set, but we do need to prove that out with our testing. For example, that the amount of area we chose, the 4,000 square feet, that will acceptably perform based on the amount of debris potential and containment.
But you're scheduling your performance testing, it sounds to me, like in parallel with your regulatory activities with the project manager or with the NRC.
Yes, sir. That's correct.
Do you think they'll come together at some convergent point such that you're not going to find yourself in a construction delay between when the two tails start to meet and it's time now to really boil down and get a final design that you can now march forward with, now construct, and now prepare to install?
Yeah, that's a good point. The schedules are tight, and we are doing work in parallel, so we continue to keep our eye on that, but we do expect that all the necessary pieces will converge for us to be successful during our outage. But that is, we have a dedicated project team on this issue, as well as the people I mentioned looking at other potential solutions. They are completely separate, so we do place a high priority on getting this resolved in time.
Somehow, you must have a date in the back of your mind somewhere that says, this has to happen by now, or I'm in jeopardy with respect to the end of 07.
Yes, sir. And that is basically the end of November of this year with the completion of the testing with our vendor.
So you're in a pretty tight window
yes.
at the moment.
That's
one
right.
last question, if you will.
Sure.
You referenced putting interceptors in here to catch your flaking. How would you verbally evaluate the condition of your coatings within containment?
At this point, I believe coatings are in relatively good shape.
Wait a minute. What does that mean?
Well, we don't have a concern for coatings clogging our sump screens. In some plants, that is an issue, where they have coatings inside containment that are peeling or flaking to a large degree, where that becomes their primary concern mm-hmm. for material that could clog the sump. That is not true in our case. In our case, the material that we are concerned about and working to eliminate is the fiberglass type insulation material.
So there's no input to the calculation.
Typically what the NRC project manager has to do is turn a crank and get a number of square feet out of it. Is that all he's waiting for? Or is there something more and something different that makes his determinations, his plant-by-plant determinations, very different?
For the project manager evaluating our scheduler reliefs, is that your question? He basically, the NRC, as I mentioned, has set forth guidance on specific items they need to see the plant having addressed before they'll grant scheduler relief. And those include things like, have you trained your operators in the potential for this to happen? Have you done anything to ensure you might have additional water inventory to flood the sump? And so the project managers, as requests come in, they evaluate those factors on a plant-by-plant basis. And the technical staff at the project manager at the NRC works with the technical staff at the NRC that handles this issue, and those included the people we met with on Tuesday. So they basically have the knowledge of the whole issue and every development in the industry, so they evaluate each plant against those requirements.
Bill, real quick, I can tell you're still uneasy on the coatings. We do at Diablo Canyon, similar to our containment concrete program that we have that includes inspections and repairs and monitoring, we have a similar type program for coatings inside containment. So we have a very large database, we have inspections, we have follow-up testing that we do. So Ken speaks from knowing that where our condition is with respect to coatings based on a program we have at Diablo Canyon.
Thanks, Steve.
There's also some issues with chemical reactions with aluminum, if I remember correctly. Is there aluminum or much aluminum in the containment, or is that also not an issue?
We do have some aluminum in containment. That's not, again, our major issue, but that is something that also factors into our calculations and our design. And, in fact, the industry with the NRC is still reviewing the final requirements for exactly what your testing protocol and what type of chemical interactions you need to consider. So on the last day, I'd say the quality organization has done a good job working with engineering, and so we continue to look at all the work that the vendors do for us. And in fact, Mr. Taggart has a quality individual basically full-time on the team with us, so we continue to look at that really hard to make sure we're getting the quality work we need from the vendors, and if we find errors, we get them corrected.
Ken, is it as simple as a sump change, design change, or are there other things you're doing to make this comply with the NRC letter?
Yeah, there are other things we're doing. As I mentioned, we'll either remove or jacket or protect the insulation materials that are the key concern. So in some cases, the intent is to double jacket, basically with metal insulation around fiberglass type material. In some cases, it will be to remove it. We have some fibrous material on cables and cable trays, and there the proposed solution is to lay a cover over the cable tray to protect it so that material couldn't be disturbed.
I guess I was getting more. I appreciate that. Are there any changes to your safety injection system timing as to when you go on recirculation, or is there a... anything, water volumes in your refueling water storage tank, anything that you're doing to change the analytical calculations in the post-accident environment?
That's a good question. For the proposed screen replacement, the answer is no. One of the mitigating measures that we have already taken is to raise the amount of water we keep in the refueling water storage tank. So we have done that. But the independent team I mentioned is looking at those other potentials. So, for example, the chemical effects concern comes about because we use a chemical, sodium hydroxide, in what we use to spray containment to reduce pressure and scrub iodine out of the atmosphere in the event of an incident. There is a potential, and the industry is actually working with the NRC to look at different buffers that may not interact with materials the same, so something different than sodium hydroxide. We'll continue to look at that. There are potentials for delaying containment spray or not needing it at all if you redid analysis, potentially. And so we do continue to look at other alternatives like that. Okay. But those aren't part of the current plan to replace the screens.
All right. Thank you.
Ken, this is going the unit. It just seems weird to me that a deadline is coming up on this low probability issue where there's still so much uncertainty and everybody moving to try to make a date and the NRC being rigid about schedule relief for a low probability issue like this, which has been with us for 40 years. Now, why is this coming to a head as much as it appears to be right now?
I don't know that I have a real good answer for that. It has been an issue that has existed for quite some period of time. The industry as a whole has been working with the NRC through the Nuclear Energy Institute, NEI, and based on my discussions with the NRC folks on Tuesday in Washington, I believe it's at a point where the NRC has done a lot of research, and although there are still certain questions outstanding, like exactly how chemicals interact with fibrous materials, their overwhelming belief is that in terms of sump screens, bigger is better, because the larger your screen, you have a higher probability of having some amount of clean screen area. And in fact, our testing that we've done so far in San Ramon has shown that. So they really want the industry to get their screens replaced and get this issue behind them.
Well, how did it get to be such a deadline issue all of a sudden?
Yeah.
Seems like all
mm-hmm.
of a sudden.
Yeah, I don't have an answer for that.
Okay, now let me give it back to Steve.
Okay, I think I have the next topic also.
Go ahead and cover your next topic.
How do they do these handoffs?
So I'm going to talk about equipment issues, and you had a few questions when Mr. Taggart was up talking about some long-standing equipment issues. So I'll cover that, some high-level things, and hopefully answer the questions you had also. So just by way of background, our Diablo Canyon business plan, which are the high-level objectives and actions that we were going to work on at Diablo Canyon for 2006, included a list of equipment issues, some equipment issues that had existed at the plant that we wanted to resolve during the refueling outage. We just had refueling out generic industry instances and notices where ECCS systems could potentially accumulate gas voids, which could lead to degraded performance of pumping systems. So in Unit 2, in the 2R13 outage, we installed a void chamber. Basically, just think of it like a kind of a 16-inch diameter pipe, just kind of a point, a dead spot where gas voids, if they existed, could accumulate. So we installed that in Unit 2. That had been previously installed in Unit 1 and was successful in eliminating any voiding that we've seen when we've gone out and UT'd piping systems. So that issue was completed in 2R13, and that standing equipment issue is now complete for both units. The fan cooler potential reverse rotation, As you know, the fan coolers are used to reduce pressure and containment during an accident, temperature and pressure. And the issue there was the potential for not, we have five fan cooler units in each unit, not all of them run at the same time. They're not needed for temperature control during normal operation all at once. And they have a louver arrangement, and there was a potential that due to airflow, we could get reverse rotation on an idle fan cooler unit. So we performed some modifications on the louver system, and we also improved our maintenance in the refueling outage. So from the tech, and we've seen good performance from that. We do not have the concerns that we had before. So from a technical issue standpoint, we believe that issue also has been resolved. I will tell you, though, the maintenance that we do on those louvers is pretty intensive. And the fan cooler units being in containment, they're not real easy to work on because it's not like they're right in front of you on the floor that you can work on them. So long term, we have our design engineering folks looking at a different potential modification, some type of anti-reverse rotation device that would allow us to reduce the maintenance that we do on them in terms of how intricately and close tolerances we need when we do this maintenance and work on the louvers.
So you haven't completely declared victory
in the reverse direction?
If we started having that kind of issue, we would have to evaluate operability of the system and, you know, make a judgment based on what we saw, whether the system was operable or not.
Well, if you turn power on, wouldn't they rotate in the right direction?
Yeah, I believe they would, but like I said, that's depending on the potential for airflows and the different combinations, we thought we needed to eliminate that as a potential.
We also evaluated the restart, the amperage that would be required to restart a fan that is rotating in reverse direction, and that started to compromise some of the margins we had in our calculations for current.
Okay. This is kind of a memorable issue because I don't have to tell you, but I will anyway, because we're talking to the general public. Mm-hmm. This was one of the several issues that the NRC cited when they flagged you very heavily for your performance improvement and resolution cornerstone problem. So you feel the organization, I hope, feels comfortable enough now at this point in time that from that perspective, you're okay. You feel okay.
Yes, sir, that's correct. Mm-hmm. So the next issue up there on the slide was diesel generator lube oil supply check valves. We had leakage through our check valves, so we relocated the valves physically in the piping system. That is all complete now for Unit 2, and your questions before were good, and now are they? So is the issue really done? So we haven't completed that for Unit 1 for each unit has three diesels, but that is scheduled, that work to be completed for all units by the end of this year, and that is on schedule. So by the end of this year, that issue will be completely resolved.
So that'll get you back into a better looking color window?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
That's correct. Okay. The next issue on the next slide is diesel generator lube oil coking, and just if you recall that coking issue is really the lube oil heaters as they initially existed in the plant were vertical. So you had a heater element maybe about that high and it was vertical, and what would happen is the heater element at the bottom, the lube oil would tend to coagulate or harden. So the design modification that we made was to take those heater elements and resolve for both units. The auxiliary feed water temperature alarms, that was really, we were getting certain temperature alarms during certain running of feed water systems, main feed water with auxiliary feed water, and that was really just an issue of the way the piping was insulated. We removed some insulation to make sure we weren't getting these nuisance alarms, so to speak, and that issue is completely resolved. And then the last issue is the charging pump 2-1 vibrations that we were experiencing on the unit 2 charging pump 2-1. So we replaced the rotating element for that pump in 2R13, and we also did some work and stiffened the pump pedestal. So that issue also is completely resolved at this point. So if I were to summarize those two slides and get back to your question on, okay, are you really completely done with each of these issues? The diesel generator lube oil heater mods will be done by the end of 1R14. The diesel check valve relocations will be done by the end of 2006. And then the fan cooler unit reverse rotation, the technical issue or operability concerns have all been resolved. But going forward, we are looking to do an enhancement so we don't have to do the maintenance, the detailed maintenance that we do. Right now, we don't have a current schedule. We're still looking at potential design alternatives for that. And that completes my presentation.
You have another list of equipment problems that you'll be working on in 2007?
We are in the process of developing our 2007 business plan, and that will include what improvements we want to make in the area of equipment reliability going forward. So we don't have that yet.
Sheila? Bill?
No.
Good.
I'm okay.
Frank?
So there was a list of some sort of long-standing equipment problems.
Mm-hmm.
Is this that list? I can't quote the precise list, but I remember there was some sort of a list that NRC or you had.
Yes, sir. That's a summary of the list that is in our business plan. I believe there were a couple of other items originally in the business plan that we changed our course on. One was the positive displacement pump that we use in the charging system. Mm-hmm. And the reservoir to do there on Unit 1, and that will be done in the next outage as well.
Okay, I recall there was an issue with leakage from the refueling water storage tank. Was that on this long-standing equipment problem list?
That is not one of the issues in the business plan. I think that was an issue that had previously been resolved.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
So is it fair to say that the official list of long-standing equipment problems will have been resolved when these are completed?
Yes, sir. That is correct. But as I mentioned to the other question, we will look at what we need to do going forward. I think some of you have had the opportunity to come to our plant health review committee meetings. So, you know, it's a dynamic thing as we have issues with systems or we need to improve our maintenance or availability. Our system engineers evaluate how our components, pipes, valves, pumping is operating, and then we will bring it to the plant health committee and schedule modifications or repair work as necessary. So we will look at what we want to add in that regard for the 2000 business plan, and then the plant health committee is an ongoing process, and I think Mr. Taggart mentioned that when he was speaking. That was one of the key reasons we had some of these issues in the past, is that we did not have a more formal structured committee process to bring those things in front of the leadership team and get them planned and scheduled. And that process seems to be working well for us now at the station. But you never declare victory overall on improving your system performance.
And we've looked at the fire protection system, and it's got some even longer-standing concerns on piping corrosion and whatnot. I know that's in the plant health committee process, and I think most of that probably has been approved by this time, but that has been and will continue to be long-standing because it's going to take so long to complete those repairs. Could you comment on that?
I don't, off the top of my head, I don't know the specifics of how long those issues have been there in the fire protection system, but I'll go back and look at that and make sure we're factoring that into our 2007 plans.
If I recall, a number of years, we look at the system health cards and mm-hmm. whatnot and some audits, QV audits of the system, and it seems like it's the year 2011 or 2012 that you finally get fire protection back, I think, to white status, maybe. Maybe it's green, I'm not sure, but it seems like an awful long time. I wasn't sure if you were sensitive to that or not.
Relative to prioritization, but I'll go back and look at that specifically.
I will agree your process is much improved. We've seen, I'd call it a step change, to quote Dave Taggart, in that area at least, so far.
Thank you.
Anything else? Ken, thank you for two very good reports. Appreciate that.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Before I turn it back to Steve, I want to comment that the tour this morning was, I think, one of the most successful we've ever had. We had a large bus. We had over 50 members of the public on the tour, including a large group of students from Cal Poly. And I want to credit our solicitor, Mr. Wellington, for getting the information over to Cal Poly and energizing a bunch of kids who made their own phone calls, made their own reservations, and came on the tour. Rob has had a chance to look at the pink sheets that we asked people to turn in with comments. And I know we will get some more, but we had 8 or 10 of them. And Rob, is there anything that jumped out at you that you want to mention to us out of that, or any other thing about this tour that you want to touch on?
I'll just mention the feedback forms we got. We got back nine, and you indicated several people said they were going to send theirs in later.
Don't hold your breath.
I won't hold my breath, but our email address is on there, so maybe they'll email us. That might be easier for the students. And from the 9 comments, most of them were very positive. I mean, they were, again, you know, people appreciate being on the tour. That's an opportunity. They think one of the comments was that anybody who lives in San Luis Obispo County ought to take this tour. So that was an example of, I think, very positive feedback that we've had both for the committee and also for the plant and PG&E.
Yeah, if they could do that, I think it would save a lot of people a lot of time and trouble. Any other members or consultants have any comment about the tour you want to add?
No, I think you've said it.
Okay. Very positive. I'll make just one anecdotal remark. I was sitting next to a woman whose daughter-in-law is an operator at Diablo Canyon, and she was excited about her daughter-in-law's work, has never been able to understand how she talks about her work, but now she thinks she'll have maybe a little bit better handle on what her daughter-in-law is doing. So.
Good.
Okay. She was glad to be there.
They went well. It's a useful thing for us.
And insights from the committee. Thank you.
Okay. Well, then we stand adjourned. I thank you all for coming. Thank you all for coming.
Excellent.
I don't know. Steve, have you and Jack talked? Jack, do you want to say anything? When there's adjournment coming, you might as well.
I'm good.
Thank you.
Okay. Can I clarify? I'll be around for a few minutes.
Great.
I'm going to run for the airport.
I figured.
Time.